This is August 3rd, and we're here tonight with David Robix, who's just completed a concert at the West Avenue Community Center. We're kind of doing a group collaborative interview tonight. We've got people here from WECS and WHUS. I'm Mike Westerfield, Chris Moritz here, John Schwank from WHUS, and George King III from WHUS. The fourth, George King IV from WHUS. And the question I was asking him as they just switched on the microphone was, how do you describe yourself? Singer, songwriter, what are the words that come after that?
Cheerleader, I guess.
Cheerleader for whom? What
for,
team?
For the left. Go red, smash state. Yeah, I mean, I sing songs, and I think the two basic roles that I feel like people like me are trying to accomplish is to inspire the troops, to be a cheerleader, to sing about the things that people are doing and try to encourage them to keep on doing it, and to, you know, try to foster a sense of community and togetherness by singing songs about what we're all doing. You know, I find it validates what people are doing when they hear a song about it, or they read about themselves in an article, or hear about themselves on the radio. It really it makes a difference for people's morale. So I'd say that's one thing, and the other is to educate people who may not know about a lot of the stuff that's going on, and tell them about what's happening, and both the good and the bad, and to try to do it in a way that they can hear it, which, you know, music has its own way of communicating that's different from other mediums, and so it's, you know, sometimes it can reach people in a way that another medium might not.
I think you're doing that educating role really, really well, because as I was listening to your concert, I was thinking, oh, I've got to mark that song and that song and that song, send it to my friend, because he's not all that willing to listen to the tapes of, like, public affairs programs that I send him. But if I send him a music tape, he might actually listen, and your lyrics are so full of content that you can actually learn quite a lot from them. Yeah. I'm impressed.
You can kind of sneak up on them that way.
Right.
You know? They don't know what they're getting themselves into until you're talking about something they didn't want to think about, but then they are because they're listening to the song.
How long have you been in this business, and how did you get into it? I look at your schedule, and you're constantly going around the world, around the country.
Yeah.
How do you keep it up?
Well, September 11th has been really good for me, I must say. I mean, it's a terrible thing to say, but it's true. And it's also, in a way, it's really a hopeful sign that you know, what's been happening recently has been scaring a lot of people, and as far as, like, their fears for how our government is going to make things worse and make the country less safe, and also, you know, the people's concern about the U.S. going and bombing everybody else around the world. And, you know, this is, for me and for, I think, a lot of other people, I've talked to various other activists and musicians in this kind of field, and they all say that, you know, since September 11th, there's a lot more interest in what they're doing and a lot more gigs. But, I mean, I've been doing it professionally for, I don't know, since 96 or so, and then before that I played in the subways in Boston all the time. And made a living as a street musician, and then eventually got enough indoor gigs that I didn't have time for the playing in streets anymore, even though I really enjoyed doing that. And how do I do it? It's just a lot of fun, and it's easy most of the time. I mean, there's times when it gets to be a drag, and I'd rather just cancel the week's activities and go hang out somewhere in the woods. But I try to schedule in enough break time, and I like being on the road most of the time, and spending most of my time on the road, it feels productive. You know, like I'm doing. I mean, because it's not really. It doesn't make a difference. The songs don't make a difference unless you get them out there. You know, they have to get out there. So. And it's great, you know, going around to different places where all these activists are coming to hear you sing a concert, and usually just wonderful people, it's generally a real pleasure. But not sleeping on couches is the secret to keeping it going. You have to have guest rooms, and you have to be able to sleep as late as you need to or want to, and not have somebody like saying, oh, I'm getting up for work at 8 in the morning, and you got to leave the house, you know. As long as those situations are avoided, then it's sustainable on a basic sort of personal, social kind of level. You know, I find I need a certain amount of privacy, which a guest room affords, and I don't sleep well on a couch. But
how do you come about writing songs? Do you do a melody first, or do you come up with the words, or have an idea about what you want to write about, like, you know, the WTO or something like that? How does the process work for you? I mean, is it different every time?
It's almost always a process of having an idea and or coming up with some kind of a catchy phrase that expresses the idea well, and then letting it sort of sit around in my head for a couple weeks usually, and then it'll sort of fall into some kind of a structure for how I want to, you know, sort of divide the concept up into verses and communicate it. Usually it's some part of the chorus that comes first, and then I'll figure out how to, and then sometimes I throw away the chorus after writing the song, but sometimes I keep it, and then the music comes afterwards, and that's like another step in the process for me, like writing the lyrics, and then I kind of leave it alone usually for a few days or a couple weeks, and then start working on the music.
I was looking at your schedule on your website recently, and I understand you're going to be traveling to Europe soon.
Mm-hmm.
When you've gone around the world, do you find any difference in the audiences? Do you get any kind of different responses from them?
Yeah, like, I mean, I've played a lot in Western Europe and throughout the U.S. and Canada, so, you know, there's an awful lot of places I've never been to. I can imagine what the responses might be like, but certainly in Europe, there's generally a huge difference between the audiences there and in the U.S. In terms of the mainstream, I mean, I can be playing for a more mainstream audience in some place in Denmark or England even, and the knowledge of the things I'm singing about and the general progressive tendencies of people is definitely more dramatic than it is among a more mainstream audience in the U.S. But of course, you know, I'm not usually playing for the mainstream here, and so actually, in terms of the progressive movement, there's very little difference. I mean, you know, progressives here, progressives in Europe, tend to be, I think, similarly knowledgeable about what's happening, and I'd say generally responses are more enthusiastic in the U.S. than they are in Europe to what I'm singing about, because a lot of it is pretty specific to what's happening here, or some of it is, and so people tend to get the jokes. I mean, like, say, for example, you know, nobody could possibly have avoided hearing the Coca-Cola slogan, "It's the real thing." You know, so when you work that into a song, then people get the joke, whereas they don't, you know, use the same slogans in their advertising in Europe, so, you know, people miss that joke, and that's true of a lot of things. And plus, Americans are generally louder and more enthusiastic than Northern Europeans, so they hoot and holler, and I feel at home. And I always wonder, like, with the, you know, the Danish audiences or the German audiences, like, are they actually enjoying this at all? Because they're certainly not showing it, you know. And then after the gig, they buy a whole bunch of CDs, and I guess, well, they must have enjoyed it, but, you know, they certainly didn't show it the way an American audience would.
I'm guessing that tonight you were singing to the choir. How often do you play to more mainstream audiences, and what's your reception like?
Well, I don't often play for mainstream audiences, at least not audiences where the majority is mainstream. Although, you know, at a lot of events, there will be some people that trickled in who weren't part of the local progressive movement. It's a problem because, I mean, for one thing, I think it's worthwhile to sing for the choir. I think that you can look at it that you can, you know, it's the troops need to be inspired and we need to have a community, and that means, you know, singing and it means eating together and hanging out together in capacities other than just, you know, at meetings or protests. But, you know, certainly there's a certain cliquish quality to the left, and it's not that we try to be that way generally, but, it can be difficult not to be, and you know, there's a lot of events where more mainstream folks who aren't involved with political events going on just don't don't hear about it, don't come. And I think a lot of that has to do with the media being controlled by a few corporations, and most people just don't get the word. So if they're not on the right email lists, how else are they going to hear about it? They're not going to hear it mentioned on the local nationalist public radio station, you know. Certainly they're not going to hear about it through CNN or through, you know, whatever Hearst paper is in their community.
As somebody who is in what you might call the more independent side of the entertainment industry, broadly speaking,
yeah.
Do you see any way of enlarging that microphone, that megaphone, and getting the word out to larger and larger people who could be receptive but just don't hear about it?
Yeah, for sure. It seems that to me that the recent developments with the internet is a very powerful thing, and basically a democratizing influence, because it's such a two-way medium, unlike, you know, corporate TV or radio. Of course, community radio is another thing that, you know, and community, you know, the occasional local paper that's actually community controlled. But I think the biggest, most exciting development, other than community and pirate radio, is certainly the internet, and the, you know, of course, you know, with the internet, all you need is the, you know, computer and the phone line. So if you don't live near a good community radio station, like the vast majority of this country, then you can, you know, you can still find out information. You can download MP3s, and just in terms of MP3s, the, you know, the thousands and thousands of people who have downloaded MP3s from my website would never have heard me otherwise, I'm sure. And so I don't think it's like, it's not just for people that already have the CD or want to get the MP3s rather than buying the CD. These are people who just stumble across me on the web, or somebody else recommended that they check out this MP3. And the way the word spreads around is so much, potentially is such a bigger thing than the way it used to spread around, I think, without the internet.
I've played a lot of your songs on the radio show, and we've never gotten a bad reaction to anything, but the one song that we haven't played, and I'm reluctant to play, is The Flag Is Just a Rag. And what kind of reaction do you get?
Did you play Children of Jerusalem?
Yes, played that.
No bad reaction.
Played just about everything. Played the Alligator Dicks, and et cetera, in prime time, and no bad reactions. But how often do you get bad reactions?
Well, I mean, you know, yeah, that's the flag rag is probably, I mean, other than Children of Jerusalem and anything about Palestine is the stuff that I've gotten the most reactions, both negative and positive. But you know, when it comes to so many issues, I mean, I think so many people in the mainstream of this country are just much more apathetic than you know, super patriotic, you know. So they, I think they generally aren't really too concerned either way. If you're singing about burning flags, people are a lot more tolerant than we often think they might be. But you know, still definitely, in the progressive movement, yeah, I've never actually, you know, had people, you know, walk out because of that song or be really upset because of that song. But certainly, some people are much more comfortable with it than others, and because of that, I don't actually sing it that often, because I don't feel like whether or not you support flag burning is a litmus test of much of anything, in terms of whether you're a good person or a good radical or whatever. But you know, certainly it is kind of a dividing line issue at the same time, I think it really comes down to the difference between the loyal and opposition and the disloyal opposition, and I certainly would be part of the disloyal. I mean, you know, there's the people who have some kind of faith in the idea of some American dream, and those that have only experienced the American nightmare, to quote Malcolm X. I mean, and I've actually noticed it, there was one really clear situation where I sang that song at this Cuba support event, and the audience was divided about a third Latino, about a third Black, and about a third white. And it was fascinating that to a person, the Black and Latinos in the audience thought the song was great, and they were often mostly very enthusiastically liked it. And the white audience, which I think was probably mainly like socialist, Communist Party folks, mostly older folks, seemed uncomfortable with it. And of course, these white folks are also radicals. But I think, you know, they're coming from a place where, like the Communist Party, where in the 30s the big slogan was communism is 20th century Americanism. You know, and they were really appealing to this whole, you know, patriotic notion and the whole, you know, notion of the great people like Thomas Paine and various others. And I'm not against that. I mean, I don't mean by writing the song, I don't mean to say that I think that appealing to those kinds of, you know, people like, you know, talking about Thomas Paine and other, you know, great Americans or whatever, I don't think that's a bad way to go as far as, you know, making a point. But I think also there's an awful lot of people, you know, especially those who have been victims of genocide and slavery, for example, to also, you know, long-standing American institutions who think that burning the symbol of the government that has either, you know, killed or enslaved them is a fine thing. And I think it's also important for people to relate to the subject that way.
You recently tried to get into Canada during a G8 summit. I was wondering if you could tell our listeners a little about your experiences of trying to get over the border.
Sure. First of all, I was worried about getting across the border because I had just played at this event in Missoula, at this wonderful sort of, you know, global justice-related event. And so, you know, I was crossing the border at the worst possible border crossing, you know, north of Missoula on the way to Calgary. It's pretty obvious why I'm going, you know, assuming they figure out that I'm a radical, and it's hard for them not to unless I travel without any CDs and, you know, nothing to identify me.
No guitar.
Yeah, no guitar. I mean, they might have let me through with just a guitar, but when they saw the CDs and they looked at my website, you know, they were hesitant to let me in. And then, but what really clinched it was there was a piece of paper that said that where they had me in their computer. They had me on a list that said, you know, don't let this guy across the border. Or it didn't actually say that. It said, you know, run him through customs and immigration and give him a hard time and, you know, basically try to find an excuse not to let him across the border. And, you know, I have no record of violent crime, so this whole idea of preventing somebody from crossing the border because of the suspicion that they might commit some kind of illegal act. And they didn't even have any record of any arrests. So it was clearly on suspicion of the possibility that I might do something illegal, as if the thousands and thousands of troops and police in Calgary wouldn't be enough to, you know, deal with somebody who might decide to throw a rock or you know, block a street or something like that, you know.
Doesn't it give you a good feeling that the authorities think you might be someone to worry about?
Yeah, I guess, you know, I was kind of honored at the same time as I was really upset not to get across the country, the border, because, I mean, it's a damn long way, you know. I drove out west, you know, for this thing in Missoula, and I lined up some other gigs along the way. But it was pretty much I was driving out west to go to the G8 protest, so it was, you know, it was a real drag. And you know, I was supposed to be opening for Bruce Coburn, and it would have been a really good gig. I definitely would have rather gotten through, but you know, but yeah, I guess it's an honor.
As you go traveling around the country, I know that I was feeling pretty despondent for a while for all the doom and gloom that Chris and I report on each week on the radio show. But when I came across you playing at one of the benefits for the Hartford 18, and then I started discovering that there were other musicians out there, mm-hmm. Bringing the movement back to life. But as you go around the country, What do you see as the most hopeful signs? What people do you see as the people who are going to bring it all together? What hope can you give us?
I mean, the fact that there's always opposition to what the government is doing, and so much so much creativity out there as far as visions of a different kind of society and people working on so many fronts, you know, petitioning the government for change, trying to, you know, protest against what the government is doing, to, you know, creating alternative models, you know, research into solar technology, and I mean, just community radio. There's just so much stuff going on, and I think all of it is really inspiring, and you know, I think we also, if we're feeling discouraged about the situation, I think it's always important to bear in mind that there's usually not a massive and sustained social movement in a country that where people are generally eating and not being bombed. And I mean, it's still with all the poverty and all the problems, it's still quite a privileged country generally. And then those that aren't privileged have an awful lot of other stuff to deal with, police brutality and everything else. But there is a skeletal movement, when you look at everything that's happening, all the different NGOs, all the different activist groups, all the different community media, and so much else. And this is the potential leadership of the next wave. And there's always going to be another wave, and it's a question of, can we take advantage of the situation? Can we bring things forward? Is there enough, expertise and commitment and direction within the movement to bring it forward when that next wave comes? But it seems to me that if you look at it that way, as a skeletal structure for the next movement, I think what we have going is pretty good. And, whether it can function well once it has more meat on its bones, is the real question.
You described difficulty getting across into Canada. Can you think of other instances where you've been oppressed in some way by authority? The authorities, I mean to say. We've all been oppressed by authority.
Well, I mean, I think the biggest form of oppression that all of us are suffering from the authorities is that they are maintaining a system, the international capitalist system that is completely destroying the planet and everything that we need to live and killing us all. So in that sense, but in terms of more direct personal experiences with the authorities, I've never been, beaten by the police or anything like that. I've been tear gassed in Quebec City, and I've been arrested for sleeping in a park once when I was 19, arrested for spray painting political slogans on buildings a couple times when I was younger. But I've never had any severe or horrible negative experiences with the authorities,
or even slight ones, like suspected that your mail was being opened or anything like that.
Oh well, I mean, yeah, I've never I've never heard those sounds when you're on the phone and you hear this little sound. You're wondering if your phone's being tapped. But I think it's a perfectly fair assumption that our mail is being read and our phones are being tapped and our email is being read. But I had my website hacked into by somebody one time, and song lyrics disappeared and were replaced by this grotesque picture. But I have no idea who did that. it was kind of weird. But actually, other people have mentioned the anti-capitalist convergence folks recently, they got a message, sent an email. They've been getting emails like that contain viruses, and they're specifically coming from people that are active around the Palestine issue. So, and I don't know which authorities would be involved with this, but certainly there's a heck of a lot of really good computer hackers in Israel. So I wouldn't be surprised if that were true, that people involved with the Palestine issue are getting their stuff hacked more often and getting viruses more often. Because certainly when my website was hacked, that was specifically the issue for sure. Because it was the lyrics to "Children of Jerusalem" that disappeared and were replaced by a grotesque picture of something that looked like a cross between a man and a cow.
And an interesting point on that, when we were busy bombing Yugoslavia, mm-hmm. I was in contact with Green Party members in Yugoslavia, and something came down the line and destroyed my hard drive.
And
I always wondered who it was.
Yeah. Yeah, and I know that a lot of Yugoslav computer hackers were, I think they took down NATO's website for a little while, and they were hacking into all kinds of stuff like that. Or whatever good it might have done.
One question I had is a couple times tonight, both in your performance and your talks between the songs, and during this interview you mentioned the importance of community and ways to make meetings more tolerable, even pleasant. How about that for a notion? Was there any particular organization? Was this like in Boston or something that you knew? I mean, I'm basically looking for an example of what has worked that other people listening might be able to practice in their own lives.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, there's, I think actually probably, you know, being an atheist, it's kind of odd to say, but I think that a lot of church groups are good examples of how meetings can be run in a more humane way. I mean, they have incorporated music into everything they're doing in churches and, most churches. And I think, you know, sing a couple songs at the beginning of the meeting, sing a couple songs at the end of the meeting. Also at churches, you know, after church, there's always food, you know, and I think that should be true with political meetings. There should be a place for people to socialize and eat and drink and talk and, after the meeting. And, those are things that people can do. And it seems, I mean, I don't go to a whole lot of meetings, but in terms of also making the meetings harder for a small number of people to dominate and control the whole thing, it seems like the 6-second rule is such a good one that, you know, just like everybody should have 6 seconds of silence after anything that anybody says, which then allows for the people who are less apt to speak up, and especially women, to speak up. And you don't need to create such a strict structure. You can create other structures, but following that silence rule, it seems to work wonders.
Well, maybe we should let David go, since he has to drive back up to Boston, and then off to
Tennessee,
Oak Ridge in the morning.
Yeah.
What's going on there?
Protest at the Y-12 nuclear weapons factory, which is on the forefront of Bush's program to plan to build these mini nukes. That's where a lot of the research and development is being done. And there's a group called Stop the Bomb, East Tennessee Environmental something or other, EREPA, but their website is stopthebombs.org, and they're organizing regular protests at Y-12, and I've been singing at them regularly for a while now.
Well, I realize that I can figure out what's going on in terms of protests around the country just by looking at your website and seeing where you're going to be.
I miss a few of them, you know, but I try to make it to them.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to be with us tonight. It was great having you.
Thank you.
And before you leave, you should give your website so people can check that out if they wish.
Oh, yeah. It's davidrovics.com. davidrovics.com.
Yeah, thanks very much, David. We really appreciate it, taking the time out.
You bet. Thank you.